Welcome, everybody. This is a beautiful shot of Weeks Bay, Alabama, and we are very happy to be here today for a very wonderful live program. My name is Lee Yokel, and I work for the Mobile Bay National Estuary Program. And I'd like to introduce with us here today, Margaret.
I'm Margaret Sedlecki, and I'm the Education Coordinator for the Weeks Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve. And after what we've been through this past week, we're just proud to be here.
Thank you guys for joining us. For those of you just tuning in and signing on to the internet, we've just left the Albemarle Pamlico Sound in North Carolina, and they did a fabulous program on habitats, and we're very pleased that they started us off today. And now you're joining us for an hour-long program about storms, hurricanes, sediments, and pitcher plant bogs. And we've had to make a few changes. You know, we've had a little bit of excitement here over the past week, and we're going to do our best to accommodate what we've had to change, and we hope you all will stick with us. Now, since you're just signing on, we'd like to orient you to what an estuary is. And I'm going to assume that a lot of you have already done a little study out there, but just to remind you and to show you where we are, estuaries are a place where rivers, like showing here in Alabama, flow down to meet marine waters. And here we have the Gulf of Mexico. This is Mobile Bay, and this is the entire state of Alabama. And the watershed for Mobile Bay drains two-thirds of the state of Alabama, portions of Mississippi, way up here little bits of Tennessee, and even Georgia. And we can process 15 to 20% of our nation's fresh water supply. So all of this drains here into Mobile Bay, and this little tiny portion, this little area right over here on the eastern shore of Mobile Bay is Weeks Bay. And Margaret is going to orient us more to the Weeks Bay watershed. Now here on the northern Gulf Coast, our estuary may not look exactly like yours, say along the Atlantic Ocean or maybe the Pacific. Some people have more rocky shores. Some people have more sandy shores. Some places have beautiful marshes like you just saw right here. But we all have this very same thing in common where our rivers meet the sea and create brackish water in really fantastic settings. And today, we're going to take you down deep and dirty into Weeks Bay. And Margaret, show us a little bit more about where we are this morning.
Okay. This is a map of the United States. And as you can see, we're way down here in Alabama, right on the coastline. And even though we don't have that large of a coast, Ivan still managed to come right at us. And we are right here. We're a sub-estuary of the Mobile Bay estuary, like Lee was saying. And these two counties, Baldwin County here and Mobile County here, show you sort of where Weeks Bay is located. And Weeks Bay is this little teeny tiny estuary down here along the bottom of the map. And if you come up here, this shows a close-up of Weeks Bay. Weeks Bay is actually fed by two freshwater rivers, the Fish River and the Magnolia River, and it opens out into Mobile Bay. Now, if you hear some background noise like cars going by or you hear some construction noise, right over this way is the Fish River Bridge. I don't know if you can see it from here, but they are building a new Fish River Bridge, and you're going to be hearing construction noise and, of course, cars going by. So that's what that's all about. Okay, I'm going to hand it back to Lee.
Okay, Margaret just showed us where we are, specifically located in Weeks Bay, Alabama. And those of you that have watched perhaps a lot of the national news programs, you may be familiar with Gulf Shores, Alabama. And it's been in the news quite a bit for the devastation from Hurricane Ivan. And here we are in Weeks Bay, and we have been incredibly fortunate compared to what has happened here in Gulf Shores. And we are going to now move over, and we're going to talk to our meteorologist that we have brought in at the last minute to tell us about storms, to inform us about hurricanes, and explain to us how some of these things happen on the Gulf Coast and why do they happen in the Gulf of Mexico. And I have Mr. Chris Dyke over here. And Chris is from the University of South Alabama. He is from their meteorology department, and they have a fantastic program. And I'd like to show over here Ashton. She is one of our student helpers today. And Ashton, what school are you from?
Foley High School.
Okay, and what grade are you in?
I'm a senior this year.
Do you have any career choices in science by any chance?
No, unfortunately not. I'm sorry.
Okay, so you just like to be out here today helping out.
That's right.
Okay. Super. Okay. All right, Chris, tell us about your program and how did you get started in learning about weather and wanting to become a meteorologist?
Okay, well, I got started out when I was in high school. We'd had every now and then guest speakers come in from the National Weather Service or whatnot over to Pensacola and talk to us about, you know, what meteorologists do and everything else. And so that really got me interested in it. And also the fact that I've been through a number of hurricanes and events, starting with Hurricane Hugo when I was in North Carolina for that. So starting from there, really, I started to develop an interest and then just kind of pursued it all through college. And right now, I'm in the Air Force ROTC, and I'll be commissioning this coming May as a second lieutenant. And right now, I know especially for meteorologists, they offer a lot of scholarships. So, you know, the money's out there if you want to be a meteorologist. But
that's pretty cool, Chris. Now, while you're in college, I know you're involved in a lot of student organizations, and you're a senior, and it's a pretty rigorous program. What sort of things do you study? And specifically as a senior, what do you have to do at South?
Well, as a senior, really, the program as a whole is divided up into, you have just basic meteorology, you have industrial meteorology, is where you look at more of the private company type things like AccuWeather and other weather sources. And then you also have environmental, where you can work for the EPA and other areas of meteorology. As a senior at the program, you work mainly with forecasting. You start to actually issue forecasts and things along that nature. So.
Pretty cool. All right, so that's what we want you to tell us about. I know that all of you were very closely watching the storms. Tell us about what is a hurricane.
Well, a hurricane really starts out as a group of thunderstorms either in the Atlantic or Caribbean or Gulf. And as they develop and start to grow, they tend to start rotating in a counterclockwise fashion. And this is due to the Coriolis force in the northern hemisphere. And because of that, as they start to rotate around, they tend to cause an upward motion of air. And as that occurs, you get more and more development of thunderstorms, and it kind of feeds itself as it goes. So it really depends on the warm water and warm air in order to help feed the thunderstorms.
So it's just one big, massive thunderstorm rotating counterclockwise?
Basically, yes. It's a bunch of big, massive storms. As it circulates counterclockwise, the pressure lowers, and then the winds pick up due to physics and other things like that.
All right, so Ivan was here. The eye of Ivan passed over this very location 1 week ago today. And so we've got a little map here, and Chris, you're going to show us the track, and you're going to tell us, like, why did areas like here, this is where Gulf Shores would be versus where we are in the Weeks Bay area, why they had got so much more damage.
All right, well, I'll start out by drawing the track, really. Ivan made landfall down here near Gulf Shores, and then it progressed up in this direction. As it moved on, it tended to lose intensity and became tropical storm, and then it caused a lot of flooding up in the north. But it caused a lot of damage down here, as many of you know from watching national news or whatnot as well. What Ivan did was, its winds circulate in this direction. So anyone over here in northwest Florida had a lot of southerly winds. This would cause a lot of water. The winds would actually push the water in towards these inlets. And so you'd have a lot of major flooding all along in here.
And this is the Pensacola area right in here, is that right? Pensacola, Florida, and then this would be Gulf Shores.
Okay, and then also we have a big tornado threat along with hurricanes. And the big tornado areas were anywhere all along out here. But a lot of tornadoes did make have an impact in this area here, as the cities of Atmore and Brewton really got torn up by tornadoes, as well as some other communities in northwest Florida. So that was the big threat in that part.
So it's more than just a big
thunderstorm. It's actually quite a chasm of small tornadoes, large tornadoes, wind gusts and bursts. So tell me, when they say a winds are blowing at 130 miles an hour, are they constant at 130 miles an hour?
Yes, when you hear a hurricane has winds of 130, that means that they're sustained winds. That means that that's a constant blowing wind. It's not just a gust that dies down.
Okay, we're going to return back to this station in just a minute, but a week ago today, we couldn't be standing right here, and we were very fortunate that parts of the marina are still with us, and so we're going to show you some before and after shots. And Margaret, let's see what this before shot is. This is a before shot of our lovely salt marsh out in Weeks Bay. And I'm going to walk over here, and I've got another student with us today, and who are you?
My name is Alex Chandler.
Okay, Alex, and I'm crossing my fingers. Do you have any hopes of studying science when you go to college?
Maybe a little. I was planning to do pharmacy over at Auburn.
Sounds good. War Eagle, anybody from Auburn watching? Okay, one of the things that's really cool about estuaries, and we want to enforce this about storms, is they have buffers. And buffers are very important protection from storms. And y'all, nobody laugh at my cartoon, please. But let's say this is the water's edge, and this is just a small beach along the edge of a bay, an inlet, or an estuary somewhere. And here we have some trees and some vegetation, and then further back, a wetland area. And this is an area similar to that that I attempted to draw that's on the eastern shore of Mobile Bay. And back here, you can see the trees, and you can see there's a slight ridge and a slight rise. And then it drops off to the back behind what's left of this dock. Here in front, where the vegetation has been removed, we just have a straight wash of sand right across. Vegetated buffers help to protect the land behind them. This small rise here, as the water comes in, it stops the velocity of the water, it catches the waves, and so it holds debris and often drops a lot of sediment here, allowing the water to flow to the back and be absorbed by the wetlands, and so there's less damage. It also provides a lot of habitat. So you can find these types of buffers. You can find them along the edges of beaches, on barrier islands and dunes, maybe maritime forests. You can find them along the edges of rivers, of levees. Even some natural lakes may have these things, along the edges of water bodies. That's what buffers are supposed to do. The problem often is that when we put in man-made structures, we take out our buffers so that things like this happen where the material washes right across. Here's another area, and this happened decades ago. Someone decided to make a beautiful lawn, and the sand has washed as far as it can, and you can see there's debris that has washed all the way to the back of this bluff. Had the buffer, as in this picture, still been there, the debris would have been caught here much closer to the edge, protecting the backside of that piece of property. So buffers are good for protection, for debris collection, water absorption, and then, of course, habitat is another issue that's been discussed today. Now, let's look at what our Weeks Bay buffer looks like. Here's a salt marsh, and I tried to attempt to draw our salt marsh. This is a picture you just saw, and another picture of our estuary, and this is the before pictures of what our salt marsh looked like. Now, let's back up, and let's look behind us. You guys saw this beautiful shot. Come on around. You saw this beautiful shot when we first opened, and you can hardly see any difference. There's not much change in the estuary. And if you look behind us, the dark green material is Juncus romerianus. The lighter green vegetation is Spartina alterniflora. And these things are very typical salt marsh grasses and are extremely important for protecting the property behind it. And you can't even tell that a storm has been through this area. All right, Margaret, you have a question? Please, let's show them where the two logs were that were out here before the before picture that you just saw. Let's show them where those logs in that piling wound up.
Okay, if we turn around and we focus back, we're going to turn all the way around, and we're going to show the cameraman. Those are our logs, and those are our pilings that used to be out in the salt marsh. So you can see the storm surge from Hurricane Ivan brought those materials from way out in the estuary across this area and deposited them there. Since we have no natural buffer left here, they were just free to be able to wash right into the building, taking that piling and jamming it through the two glass windows at the edge of what used to be a restaurant. Now, That's not the only thing that happened here. We've got some more information. There's a weather station that was on a dock here, and we'd like to show you a before picture of that weather station, and then we're going to find out what it was able to tell us. So here is our nice, beautiful dock and our weather station, and I'm going to walk back over to our meteorologist, and I'm going to walk back over, and we're going to have a new person. Okay. All right. First, I'd like to introduce for you guys, this is Dr. Scott Phipps, and what do you do here, Scott?
I'm the research coordinator here at the Weeks Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve.
Okay, and you've got something there from...
We have, here at the reserve we have a weather station that you can see in the background. It's a little damaged, but it's still taking data.
So this dock has been completely wiped out, but we're really fortunate that we were able to collect some really cool information.
Also, underneath of that weather station in the water is a data sonde that looks like this that's collecting data on water quality. This takes data every 30 minutes. The weather station takes data every 15 minutes. And those instruments collected data through the hurricane, and we've got that data here.
Okay, so Scott and Chris, we have got some really cool stuff that you guys pulled out of that data logger at the very last minute. So let's have a little discussion. Tell us about some of this information and what does it mean? Who wants to go first?
I can tell you about the data and then I'll let Chris tell you what it means. And in these charts, these two top charts came from the weather station. This one shows with the kind of purple line is barometric pressure. You see that barometric pressure dropped dramatically during the time when the hurricane passed at this point here. The blue line shows wind speed. Wind speed built to a peak at the eye wall, and then as the eye passed over, wind speed dropped to almost nothing, and then quickly built right back up again as the second part of the eye wall passed over.
That's pretty cool. All right, what does that mean, Chris, in terms of barometric pressure?
Well, the pressure you can use to signify exactly where the eye actually came across. And as we can see with this little dip right here, that shows that that's where the pressure was the lowest, or this essentially the eye of the storm.
Okay, I understand that there may be some questions now. We have some things coming in. Let's turn around and take a shot. Back here, we have had to go to Plan B because of Hurricane Ivan, and so we have someone on a cell phone calling the Weeks Bay Reserve who are getting your questions off the internet and bringing them to us via cell phone. Come on out, Mr. LG, to tell us what your questions are so that we can begin to address some of that interest I know that you have. All right, LG Adams, on the scene. LG, what do you do here at the Reserve?
I try to keep things running right and keep everybody on the job and on task, that kind of stuff.
Okay, you've got a question for us.
I do. I have lots of questions. They just keep rolling in. Many of them are hurricane-related, so I think people are responding to some of the information that you've been talking about. I have one from Appleton Elementary in Columbia, Maryland, and they want to know, how has Hurricane Ivan impacted estuary life?
Wow. Who would like to talk about that? Hey, Margaret? Margaret and I sat down together. What day was that, Margaret?
It was Monday. When we finally got back to work and we got electricity on, and Lee and I frantically came down here, looked at all the damage, and within one day we had to totally rewrite our script. It was very... stressful for us, and it still is stressful. So it totally disrupted things.
Right, but we've left everything just as we found it so that you could see what it looks like right after a hurricane. Okay, Mr. LG, what do we have?
Here's another one from Bayside Academy, 6th grade in Daphne, Alabama. I believe it's Sally Wilson's class. What happens to the organisms when a hurricane increases the freshwater content in such a short period of time?
Wow. Hey, Dr. Phipps, Mr. Research Coordinator here, can you help us with that question?
I'll try. A lot of the organisms that live in estuaries are adapted to rapid changes in salinity. Some of them move with the fresh water or with the salt water. They leave the area like fish and such. But plants, if plants survive in an estuary, they have to be able to withstand rapid changes in salinity. And the plants that live here have withstood those rapid changes many times in the past.
And that's as evidence in the salt marsh that we were just looking at. Okay, LG, do we have another question?
We have more questions than I think we have time to deal with. But here's one from Curry School in Birmingham, Alabama. It looks like gate grade 5. And they want to know what kind of bivalves live in the estuaries around Mobile Bay.
Scott, do you know about bivalves here?
Well, of course, there are oysters just outside of Weeks Bay and Mobile Bay. There are also ribbed mussels and several other species that I'm not real familiar with bivalves.
Okay, Scott is a big plant person, and we're going to see him a little bit later in the segment. Now we're going to go on to the next phase of our program. And originally, we had intended to talk a lot about sediments and mud and the stuff between our feet. And as I'm walking along, I'm getting stuff in my sandals and in my Tevas. And this is pretty cool material. And I'm going to introduce you guys to our senior sedimentary geologist, Dr. Mud, our local sedimentary expert, Dr. Doug Haywick. He's a Canadian, but that's okay. We like him down here. He's doing a great job for us. Doug, what is all this stuff over here?
Well, obviously what you're standing on is sand. It's sediment. The question, I guess, is where does it come from? Obviously, the most obvious area it comes from is from behind us where Weeks Bay is. But there's a much more involved story than this. For this, we have to actually look at the geology of the state of Alabama. You've already seen the watershed map of Alabama, so you know that there's an awful lot of rivers that are all draining down to this one point on the Gulf of Mexico. The thing to note is that not only is this bringing water down from inland of Alabama, it's also bringing a lot of sediment. Ultimately, all this sediment came from areas to the north where the rivers started off from. This is a geological map of Alabama. For those of you that are not familiar with geological maps, which is most of you, it might look a little bit scary at this point. All the different colors here refer to different ages of rocks or different types of rocks. Now, we live right at the southern edge of the Appalachian Mountains, and the southern edge of the Appalachian Mountains is around through here, which is an area we usually call the fall line. So up in this area here, near the Birmingham area, we have pretty good mountains, at least as impressive as the Appalachian Mountains get. Once you get south of Birmingham, south of Montgomery, down into what we call the coastal plain, things kind of get a little bit flatter, and to some of my colleagues, things get a little bit more boring, but not to me. All these belts of rocks here are sedimentary rocks. These rocks were deposited when the dinosaurs were still around. And of course, the modern sediment down here is where we are today. So your question of where the sediment came from, it came from obviously the surrounding coastal areas, but ultimately it came from the mountains and worked its way down this area.
So potentially that sand that I just picked up could be millions and millions of years old.
It could even be billions and billions of years old, and it could have been recycled a dozen times. And what you see being deposited here ultimately will get turned into rocks, and it will be eroded and turned into beach sand that might wash up in some beach 100 million years from now in the future.
That's pretty cool. All right, we've got a game here that parents, teachers, homeschoolers, you all can do this at home. And so we're going to come back here, and Dr. Haywick is going to help us, and we've got some students here. First of all, everybody out there, I want you to get a pad of paper, okay? I want you to take a pencil, and I want you to write down 1, 2, 3, and 4. And we're going to play a game, and we're going to see which one of these sediments settle in the water the fastest. And you're going to have 1 for gravel, 1 for coarse sand, 1 for fine sand, and 1 for mud. And estuaries have a unique setting and a unique type of material on the bottom of them, and we want to understand how we can connect this to what gets turned over in the wave action that's out there and in the currents, and maybe reflect a little bit about turbidity that Dr. Haywick will tell us about in a minute. All right, so let's go over here. All right, everybody, Dr. Haywick, do you have your whistle here to start the game? Okay. Alex, what have you got?
I have gravel.
Okay. All right. And Ashton?
Coarse sand.
Okay. Ah, we have a new student. Who is this?
I'm Javier. I'm from the University of South Alabama. I'm a meteorology student.
Okay, and so you're out here today with Chris. Yeah, Javier thought he was just going to be a backup, and he's on camera. So go, Javier. All right, and who do we have down here?
I'm Adam St. Lawrence.
Okay, and what school do you go to?
St. Patrick's in Robertsdale.
Pretty cool. And when you got home from Hurricane Ivan, what was the first thing that you saw?
A bunch of trees and rubble and stuff like that.
All over, every street. Okay, and what size sediment do you have?
Mud. You have, what's that?
Mud.
Mud. All right, you guys. All right, everybody, I want you to get your cups ready. All right, you got your stopwatches ready. Okay, everybody at home, I hope you've written down your answers, okay?
On your mark, get set.
Start your stopwatches. Whoa, what is going on here? Look at that stuff. All right, Doug, you want to find out what we got going on times?
All right, what you probably have seen is that some of these columns have settled out a lot faster than others. And let's see just how long it took for the first one to settle out, the gravel.
3.31
seconds. 3.31
seconds.
How about the coarse sand?
8.5 seconds.
And the fine sand?
31.19 seconds.
31.19 seconds. And how are you doing here on the mud?
Still going.
It's like the ever-ready battery rabbit. It's still going and going and going. Now, what we're seeing here is the difference in terms of grain size. Grain size is very important. The sediments being brought into bays is going to be of different sizes. The coarser it is in general, the faster it's going to settle out.
Okay. I understand we've got some questions that are about to burn off the page. LG, please come. Grace us with your questions.
Okay, a lot of questions still are coming in concerning the hurricane, but we do have a smattering of different topics. Here's one. It is from E.K. Poe in school in Durham, North Carolina, and they want to know, do people swim in estuaries?
Absolutely. And on a prior program, I swam in the very estuary back behind us. We're not going there today. Okay, next question.
Here's one from Ritter Elementary in South Rockwood, Michigan. It's a fourth grade class, and they want to know, since the Great Lakes watersheds reach the ocean, do we have any effect on your environment?
Ooh, that's a good question. What do you think, Doug Haywick, geology professor?
That's a very good question, actually. There's not as much an effect in terms of the sedimentology, in terms of the grain size component, but there is a biological factor involved in this. For example, there are some problems up in the Great Lakes involving introduced species, such as the zebra mussel. The zebra mussel has been a real problem up in the Great Lakes for a long time, and we're now starting to find it appearing in our neck of the woods. Not to the best of my knowledge, Weeks Bay, but it's certainly starting to show up in the Mississippi Delta region. So yes, there is some impact.
That's pretty interesting, and maybe ideas for a future estuary life program. Do we have another question, LG?
We do. Beechwood Elementary in Beechwood, New Jersey. And they want to know, how big is an average estuary?
Wow, that is a really good question. And let me think. If you think about the Mississippi River, and we think we have a program called the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program that's south of New Orleans, their estuary is linked all the way up through the central portion of the United States. So their estuary is absolutely huge. Our estuary here in the state of Alabama is the sixth largest watershed in terms of size. And we're the fourth largest in terms of how much water is drained through the estuary. So that sort of gives you an idea and a place of how big a watershed might be and relationship to the actual area of location for an estuary. Do we have any time for one more question? We got one more question, and then we'll move on to our next part.
Okay. This is Trinity Lutheran School in Hicksville, New York, grades 6, 7, and 8. And they want to know, has the hurricane affected marine life and wildlife here at Weeks Bay?
That's a very good question. And I do know that some of our oystermen here are beginning to go out and assess the damages that may have occurred to the oyster reefs in the area. And they're finding some areas are cut back in production by as much as a half, and some areas they can't really go and collect the oysters at this time because they've been damaged. Okay. We have another component about estuaries, and I'd like to show you a before and after picture. Did you want to do another question? No. All right. We're going to do a before and after picture, and we're going to switch over here. We're going to show you the picture of the Fish River Marina and Bait Shop. And while you guys are looking at that, we are going to move over to the bait shop, and that's the before picture, and we're going to show you what the bait shop looks like afterwards. And I believe that there should have been a key to that picture showing up for you guys. And you can see, look, here's a log that has washed up in front of the bait shop, and this is part of the old restaurant that used to be here. And as we approach the bait shop and the marina, we're going to see that there is quite a bit of damage that has occurred to the Fish River Marina. And since we're talking about sediments today, we're going to look and see just what has actually gone on inside the bait shop. And Dr. Haywick has studied about sediments and storms and their relationship right here in Weeks Bay, and he's going to reflect that study for us. And now, Doug, were you actually going to go inside the bait shop?
I would love to go inside the bait shop because there's sediment in the bait shop, and I go where the sediment is.
All right. While I stand here, I'm going to send my buddy Doug into the damaged bait shop to see what he can find.
I hope there are no snakes. I don't like snakes.
He says no snakes? Well, you never know. You know, snakes like to come out in high water. So what do we got in there?
We've got sediment.
Sediment! All right, that's what we're all about.
Wonderful, wonderful sediment. And you know what? This is a surprise. I was really surprised to see this, because most of Weeks Bay is actually bottomed out by very fine mud, like the fourth column that we had settling out there. It's fine grain material because it's a very low energy environment. And look at this. This is sand. This is very well sorted sand. You only get sand like this if the currents are moving really, really fast, which means that the currents must have been moving really, really fast right where we're standing here.
Blasted right here through the bait shop.
Well, that explains why there isn't a bait shop anymore to speak of, I guess. It's just the currents just moved everything. And incidentally, this is sand. This comes from the Appalachian Mountains, ultimately. But when you have strong currents, strong waves, and strong wind, even the strangest thing becomes sediment. We have gas pumps over here and trees around the corner, and there's stuff here we don't even know where it came from. So it all becomes part of the materials being moved in the currents.
And that reflects the strength of the water as that surge was coming right here through Weeks Bay.
Indeed. And there's one other thing we should say, too, that, you know, everyone's probably thinking this was a terrible event and it's one of these things that only happens once and then never again. That's not true. We find evidence of hurricanes that have come through here time and time and time again. If I can just show you this core over here.
Okay.
This is a sample of sediment that we took out of Weeks Bay a couple years ago, and it doesn't look very pretty because it's basically this bottom sediment that underlies all of Weeks Bay through here. There are bits that are kind of muddy, and there are bits that are kind of sandy. The sand indicates deposition at a time when the currents were a little bit higher, and the mud indicates currents that are slower. So we can actually look at the changes over time. This is a 6,000-year record.
Whoa! And so how many storms do you think could have happened in this 6,000 years?
Well, at one point, we lost count in terms of tracking them. There are literally dozens of different events that we can see. If there's something that puts sand in the middle of Weeks Bay, it must have been a powerful event. The same reason we have sand in the storefront here. So we see these throughout the record. So hurricanes happen all the time. They're natural events.
So in the last 10 years, Hurricane Ivan isn't the first storm that we've had, and you've actually had an opportunity to study that. Is that right?
Yes, we've been actually very fortunate because we've had several storms that have passed right over this area, and they have actually done different things. This is a picture of what most of the sediment underlying Weeks Bay is, and it's ooey, gooey, nasty stuff. I kind of like it, though. It's like making mud pies, and I'm older than I should be in enjoying mud pies, but never mind.
Yeah, and where did this come from?
This actually came from one of the buildings here. It's sediment that's inside the buildings. And this is muddier, which indicates it was a slower energy environment than the sand was over here. But that, more or less, is what underlies all of Weeks Bay. This map, and again, this is a detailed map. Geologists like maps. That's why we're always showing them. All the pink color that you see here is this stuff. And you can see that the majority of Weeks Bay is actually covered in this material. The yellow that you see is sand. Now, this map was made immediately after Hurricane George hit this area in 1999 or 98. I'm starting to forget now. And you can see that there's a lot of sand that comes down from this part of the estuary. That's coming in from the Fish River up here. And there's also sand coming in from this area. We often forget that while there are a couple rivers that are feeding into Weeks Bay, there's also an inlet to Mobile Bay. And during Hurricane George, a tremendous amount of water flowed in from Mobile Bay and brought sand with it. So we refer to this as a storm current or surge deposit. We haven't yet figured out what Ivan has done here, but I can guarantee you that we're going to start looking at this as soon as possible, because our bet is that Ivan made as many changes to Weeks Bay as Hurricane George did.
Okay, so Doug, if a lot of the students out there today are interested in geology, what sort of things do they need to do in school to start preparing themselves?
Well, first of all, do well in school and do as much science as you possibly can. I mean, I do geology because I love geology. It's the most fun science, I think, that is out there. Take chemistry courses, take physics courses. Don't be afraid of science. I mean, science is fun. I mean,
cool.
Where else can you get paid to play in the mud?
Okay, I think it's time for some questions. And LG, I'm sure you've had some more rolling in. What have we got here?
Yeah, we have a lot of questions coming in. Let's see, here's one from Trinity Lutheran School in Hicksville, New York. Do all particles get stopped by the buffers? Did the hurricane affect the way the water moves?
Wow, we've got two different questions. Do all particles get stopped by buffers? No, not all particles get stopped by... I can't speak, can I? Not all particles get stopped. Some will get through, as evidenced by that nice muddy mess. But the water velocity slows down, which allows those particles to settle out at different locations along the way. Now, what was the second part of that question?
Did the hurricane affect the way the water moves?
How about Chris? Would you like to talk about how the water moves?
Yeah, sure. Well, like I talked about earlier, with depending on where the storm makes landfall, in the Gulf Coast, the way we're set up, the storm made landfall in Gulf Shores, so anything east of Gulf Shores, the water movement was more inland, while everything on the west had a northerly wind, so it was actually pushing all the water out of places like Mobile Bay, even on into New Orleans and along the Mississippi Gulf Coast.
And actually, believe it or not, even though you see all this damage here, we were very fortunate because the water got pulled out of the bay and then the surge came in. So we didn't have as high a water surge as we could have possibly had. Okay, Mr. LG, more questions.
I think we have one for Chris here. It's from Dorothy L. Beckwith School in Massachusetts, a seventh grade science class, and they want to know, why did you want to become a meteorologist? How hot does it get in Alabama? How many days has the longest hurricane lasted in Alabama?
Ooh.
And did the hurricane affect any of the animals in the estuary? So maybe we should start with,
wow,
why did you want to become a meteorologist?
Okay, well, I wanted to become a meteorologist because of all the events that I had gone through. I've been through Hurricane Hugo and several outbreaks of tornadoes and then blizzards and things along that nature. And that really interests me into finding out why these natural processes occur and what is their reasons, what's their purpose. And so that's really one of the reasons why I really got into meteorology, was to find out why these events take place. So what was the second part of the question?
Okay, how hot does it get in Alabama? It gets hot. Let me tell you, hot. Okay, what's some good average temperatures for South Alabama?
Okay, average temperatures in the summertime, you're probably looking at in the lower 90s, anywhere from 91 up to 95. And in hot summers, you could probably get average up to 96 or 97. As far as in the wintertime, we're not too cold. You know, probably average around 50s. You know, every now and then we'll get down into 30s or 20s, but most of the time we stay around the 50s.
When it snows here and you see like 3 flakes of snow dropping down, everybody freaks out and all the roads close and we all stand and watch it. And I know that seems really strange to you guys. Okay, what's another part of that question?
How many days has the longest hurricane lasted in Alabama?
Wow, would that be Hurricane Danny, do you think?
That probably would. Hurricane Danny, I know, stayed in Mobile Bay. It moved all the way up into Mobile Bay and then sat there and just stalled out for a good 3 days easily. And so I would say probably about, if I remember right, about 5 or 6 days would be the longest that a hurricane has affected our area right here.
Wow. And for those of you watching, Hurricane Danny was a Category 1 hurricane as opposed to Hurricane Ivan that was a 3. And it rained and it rained and it rained a lot more than this storm has produced rain. Okay. How else? What else? You guys had a lot of questions in that one question.
Here's an interesting question. You may have touched on it already. From Tiffin City Schools at Noble Elementary in Tiffin, Ohio. And they were wondering, did the eye of the hurricane come directly over your area, and were there any tornadoes spawned from the hurricane in your area?
Excellent question, and yes, the eye moved right over this very location. Chris, tell me, how big was the eye for Hurricane Ivan?
Well, the eye, from people who were here in the county, who I know that had stayed, they were able to actually go outside and walk around, which I don't suggest, but they were actually able to walk around the eye for about an hour. So the eye was a good at least 30 miles wide. And as far as the tornadoes go, yes, they did spawn a lot of tornadoes. I know I was staying over in Pensacola, and we had like at least 3 or 4 tornadoes easily just in my area alone.
Locals will often report by observing their neighbors' homes or their streets that small tornadoes may have come through and taken out the tops of trees but not actually touched the ground. And it's always very hard, I believe, isn't it, Chris, to be able to really know exactly how many small or large tornadoes are spawned during a hurricane.
Yeah, it's really difficult to determine initially. You have a lot of things to look at as far as like damage pattern and other things. You could have mesovortices or, you know, microbursts and things like that. So.
Whoa, big words. You guys can look those up at home. All right, now we're going to move on to the next part of our program. We've been talking about mud. We've been talking about estuaries. And there's a really cool thing here in Weeks Bay that is called a pitcher plant bog. And, Margaret, I'm going to hand it off to you.
Okay. The next portion of the show is going to be about bogs. And at this point, we're going to roll that beautiful bog footage. Now we're going to go visit a bog. And bogs are very unique and special places. A bog is really just simply a low area where the water table stays really close to the surface. The soils are somewhat acidic. And because of that, layer upon layer of decaying plant matter usually accumulates. And the Weeks Bay Bog is a very unique place because we have actually put a boardwalk through the bog so that visitors can go through there and see all the plants up close without actually damaging the bog. And the most common question that most people ask when they visit the bog and see it for the first time is, why isn't the bog wet? Because most people are more familiar with cranberry bogs in the Northeast or peat bogs. Well, the bogs in South Alabama and along the northern Gulf Coast don't have a lot of peat in them, and they also don't have cranberries in them. But our bogs have very special plants, which are carnivorous plants, and there are several different species of carnivorous plants in our bog, one of which is called the white top pitcher plant. And these pitcher plants are the dominant pitcher plant species in our particular bog. Along with pitcher plants, we have some little pink sundews, which are about the size of a quarter, and we also have some thread leaf sundews. And those two carnivorous plants actually trap and digest gnats. They obviously, you can see from the little sticky dewdrops on them, that they are not large enough to trap anything as big as a moth or a lizard, in the case of some things that we have seen in pitcher plants before.
You know, when most people hear the word carnivorous plant, they think about something like this. This is Adam, and it looks like he's totally being consumed by kudzu. And kudzu is an invasive exotic species of plant that has just about eaten the whole southeastern United States. But that's not really what carnivorous plants are all about. Carnivorous plants are really plants like these that you'll see out in the bog. And there's a really good reason why carnivorous plants trap insects and digest them. And at this point, we're going to roll some more footage to let you know about those plants.
students are fascinated by carnivorous plants, sometimes called insectivorous plants. A great deal of biology may be learned by studying them. They don't capture insects for a food source. Like all green plants, they're able to make their own food by photosynthesis, but they need the nutrients found in insects to build their tissues when they grow and reproduce. In most settings, plants and animals die. Their nutrients are returned to the environment by decomposers, and the nutrients are then absorbed by plants that reincorporate the nutrients into their own molecules. In wetland environments like bogs, water is stagnant and therefore low in oxygen. Compounds from decaying plants accumulate and increase the acidity over the water. When the water becomes acidic, two things happen. First, many microorganisms which aid in the decomposition cannot function. So when the plants die, they do not rapidly decay. They just become waterlogged. With little decomposition, there are few nutrients for plants. Second, when the soil is very acidic, it is difficult for a plant to assimilate nutrients. Both of these factors, decreased composition and the difficulty in obtaining nutrients from acid water, contribute to make bogs nutrient-poor habitats. Since the carnivorous plants are unable to get enough nitrogen from the soil, their leaf structures have adapted over time to be able to trap and digest insects. Proteins of the insects' bodies are rich in nitrogen, and the carnivorous plants can use this nitrogen for their own purposes. So carnivorous plants are photosynthesizing sugars and starches used for energy, but are trapping insects as a source of nutrients, in this case nitrogen. In addition to low availability of nutrients, fire is also an important component of bogs. Fire inhibits the growth of woody shrubs. Bog plants are adapted to fire. Fire triggers reproduction and growth and inhibits competition.
Now that you know why carnivorous plants need to trap insects and eat them, let's look at some of the plants that we actually have out on the Wheats Bay Bog and look at how they actually trap insects. In this pan, we have some very small dwarf sundews, and these are only about the size of a quarter. And they have very small, sticky droplets on the end of the hairs on each of their leaves. And these can only trap, of course, things that are about the size of a gnat. This is another type of sundew called a threadleaf sundew. And this one also has sticky hairs all along the leaf of it. And as you can see, it's trapped something fairly large, which is a love bug that we have around here. And we'll see a lot more of those in just a few minutes. Okay. Scott, how about we cut one of these pitcher plants and we'll see what's in it. Now, this is actually the leaf of a pitcher plant. They grow out in the bog like this, and the leaf is very long, and as you can see, the leaf is green. So, because it's green, it can actually photosynthesize just like any other green plant photosynthesizes. But as you saw from the video clip earlier, carnivorous plants actually use insects as sort of like people use vitamins. The bog soils, because they're acidic, that is very nasty, isn't it? And I wish this was smell-o-vision because it really reeks. It smells extremely bad. And I told you that we had love bugs here, and it looks like that this pitcher plant is just completely engorged with mainly love bugs, but I see a couple of other bugs that Scott's picking out here for us. And as I was saying, carnivorous plants actually use the insects like people use vitamins. They produce their own food through photosynthesis, but because the soils in the bog are very acidic, and they're hydric, they don't hold very much nitrogen. And so these plants are actually digesting the insects and using them as a way to get more nitrogen that they need. Okay, Scott, tell us about some of these insects that you can see.
There's several moths.
both large and small, many different kinds of flies, but the preponderance is love bugs. These are a black fly that is common around here. And as you go down the plant from the top to the bottom, you see they become more and more digested. Down in this area, they're almost liquid. They're more digested, and that's where the plant is absorbing the nutrients from this water.
Tell us about those things called love bugs. Are those native to this area? And what's actually the scientific name of those things?
These are Plessia nearctica, and they're native to Central America, but they've been moving north for many years, and they're found as far north now as Wilmington, North Carolina. And the larval stage they're kind of a fly, so the larval stage is a maggot, and they digest organic material in forest floors, and they become adults and all fly around and mate, and they do something that is called synchronous mating, when all of the adults come out at the same time and fly around and find mates. That helps them make it easier to find mates, and it also helps them to guard against predation. But what it does for us is that we see millions and millions of love bugs flying around at the same time, usually in mid-May and in mid-September, like it is now.
Okay, these are called, this particular type of pitcher plant is the dominant pitcher plant out in the Weeks Bay Bog, and it's called a white-top pitcher plant. Pitcher plants are called pitchers because, we have another bug that's trying to get in the pitcher plant as we're talking. It's buzzing around on the tray. Pitcher plants are called pitcher plants because of their shape, and they actually don't hold, this particular variety doesn't hold a lot of water. Like if you went out in the bog and you picked one and you tried to pour the water out of it, there really wouldn't be any water that would come out much. There would be, in this case, love bug juice, which smells really, really bad. But there is liquid down in the bottom of this plant. And when the insect crawls down into the top of this plant, then there are some little tiny hairs that line the upper hood of the plant. And as the insect climbs down into the plant, then the downward pointing hairs actually trap the bug and keep it from flying out. Now, Scott can probably tell us what he thinks attracts the insects to the pitcher plant.
Well, for one thing, especially in the case of these Plessia, these love bugs, the color of the pitcher plant itself and the patterning, and also the carbon dioxide given off by the decomposing organisms within the plant, both of those attract these flies. Also, basically, so it's scent and color. One of the reasons why these plants have these bright red and white tops to them is they attract flying insects with that color. And
Scott, about how many different types of carnivorous plants do you think are in our bogs?
We have at least 5 species of pitcher plants, maybe more, and I'm not sure how many of the Drosera, probably 3 or 4 of those. We have species like this that are tall and catch flying insects, all the way to species that lay down. They're called prostrate, which means they lay on the soil, and they catch species like ants, things like that, crawling insects.
The other day when we were dissecting a pitcher plant, for the first time, we actually found a lizard that was decomposing inside the pitcher plant. And I think it's probably a toss-up as to which thing actually smelled the worst. I can't think of anything that smells worse than these love bugs. How about you, Adam? You think these bugs smell bad?
They smell pretty bad.
So, but they do sometimes catch larger prey like lizards and small frogs. We have LG here, and I think he's got some questions for us. come over here between
us. I have one question from two different schools, from Walnut Street School in Tom Rivers, New Jersey, and also Our Lady of Mercy School in New York. Why do they call them love bugs?
They're called love bugs because the only time we see them is when they come out to mate, and so we see them mating, and that's the part of their life cycle that we see. But they have a normal life cycle like other organisms. It's just that most of that life cycle is spent in the soil, and we don't see what they're doing there.
You know what's good about it is that love bugs don't bite. If they actually bit, we would be in big trouble because there are just thousands and thousands around here. Okay, LG, got another question?
Yeah, here's one. From the reserve staff at the reserve in North Carolina, what's on your shirt? Maybe we can check out that shirt.
Oh, they're talking about Adam's shirt. I thought I had some love bug stuff on my shirt. Adam has on our Estuary Live shirt that we had created. And maybe Lee could come over here and tell us who the artist of this picture is. But basically, this is supposed to look like mud. And this is a white top pitcher plant, and it's got two eyes looking out at us, resembling some kind of critter that's down in there. And the lady that designed it gave it some arms and legs. And what was her name, Lee?
Let me tell you, I'm downwind of the pitcher plant now, and I can smell it. Miss Jandon Richards, who is a graphic artist that teaches at Spring Hill College in Mobile, designed this logo for us, and we're very happy. She thought this pitcher plant dude would sort of give us the feel of being carnivorous and eating something at the same time while being fun and talking about our program.
Say, LG, do we have some more questions?
We have questions, 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 questions. Here's one from Carroll High School in Ozark, Alabama. How long does it take a pitcher plant to digest an insect, and what type of root systems do they have?
Say, I'm going to let Dr. Scott Fitz answer that one for us.
Well, the time probably depends on how many there are. The pitcher plant secretes enzymes. If there are a lot of them, like there are right in this pitcher plant, it probably takes quite a while. Pretty well everything that bog plants do are either very, very slow or very, very quickly, and that's to conserve nutrients. So probably in this case, it takes quite a while, maybe as much as several weeks to completely digest an insect. The root system of pitcher plants is a spreading root system that has what we know as rhizomes or underground stems that spread throughout the soil, and the plant actually spreads itself with that root system. So new plants come up from the roots at quite a distance from the old plants. In fact, they spread more readily from their root system than they do by seeds.
Okay, an interesting thing about pitcher plants is that they do have blooms, and this is a bloom, and the bloom comes up right next to the pitchers out in the bog. Now, they usually bloom in late spring, so this bloom is kind of shriveled up, as you can see, because it's a late bloomer. And these things are, a lot of people mistake them. They don't realize that they're actually the flower of the pitcher plant, but that's exactly what that is. Okay, do we have any other questions?
We do. Here's one from Sapori School in Galveston, Texas. Can carnivorous plants hurt you?
That's an easy one. No, they can't hurt you at all. They are they're passive aggressive. They sit out in our bog and they lure insects and small critters like lizards and sometimes small frogs into them by their smell and by their coloration, but they're totally harmless to humans. They couldn't do anything to hurt you if they wanted to, except get juicy bug goo on you if you start to, get it on you.
Here's a question And actually, we don't have the school, but they're asking how deep is the pitcher plant bog, and do you have Venus flytraps in Alabama?
I'll let Scott answer that one, or take a stab at it anyway.
Well, we don't have Venus flytraps in Alabama. And as far as how deep the bog is, I'm not sure about that. Is Dr. Haywick around? Dr. Haywick can probably tell you more about that.
No, he can't. We actually haven't managed to put a core down through it yet, but that's one of the things we were planning to do. I suspect it's going to probably only be on the order of a few meters in terms of thickness. You got to remember that the bay changes constantly, so the pitcher plant bog may only be less than 100 years old, and prior to that it was something else. So it's pretty thin.
You have to remember that there are different species of pitcher plants in different areas of the United States. So we have white top pitcher plants here and the threadleaf sundews and the dwarf sundews, but other people in other bogs throughout the United States may have different types of carnivorous plants. Okay, we have, I think, 4 minutes left. So I think we're going to go back to Lee, and we're going to let Lee check on that sediment settlement race and see how that sediment's coming. Here you go, Lee.
Thank you, Margaret. Thanks, you guys. Man, I'm glad to get away from that pitcher plant. Okay, we're going to swing around over here, and you can see the damage of the storm up close and personal, and we're going to come back to our sediment settlement race, and we're going to see how that muddy water has been doing. Dr. Doug, Dr. Haywick, Mr. Mud, please come and tell us what's happening. What's going on? All of these look pretty much settled to the bottom. What's happening here? Come back over here where the mic is.
Well, I think you'll see that the coarsest grain material is already at the bottom, whereas the finest grain material, the mud, is still sitting in the water column. And this is a good time to probably just comment on the turbidity of water. When mud gets washed into a bay, fine grain material, it may take days or in some cases weeks for it to settle out entirely. So that's one of the reasons why some of our water isn't the most attractive looking around here.
That's right. That's a natural way our bay is supposed to look like this. Sedimentation is a natural process, and so is turbidity. Now, if you would like to do this game at home with your teachers, with your kids, you can go to mobilebaynep.com, and you can download this exercise and do it yourself. Quite easy to do. And now we're going to be getting everybody together. Where's my meteorologist, Chris? I want you to tell us, what is your website if students would like to come and see your student organization online?
Okay, well, to get access to our website, you can go to www.southalabama.edu/meteorologyclub. There you have our local AMS chapter, which can also link you to the department page or any other pages relating to weather.
And so we might actually see you broadcasting on that page, is that right? Okay, Margaret, I want you to help me thank everybody here. Let's introduce some folks.
There are a whole lot of people that are behind the camera that you have not seen, and they have spent hours of their time helping us out with this event, especially Mike Shelton, who is over here. He is our director, and he's been keeping us on time and giving us all these weird hand signals and faces. And then we have all of these people back here who have been changing props and helping with the graphics. And one of our main people, Sarah Johnston, is not in this picture because she was the one who stayed behind at the reserve to download the email questions that you all sent to us so that we could have questions. Anything else you want to say, Lee?
Well, do we have a last-minute question? I think we have just enough time for one more question, LG. One more. What do you have for us?
From Tiffin City Schools, Noble Elementary Building in Tiffin, Ohio, they're wondering, they did a quick survey of their favorite seafoods, and those favorite seafoods were shrimp, crab legs, lobster, flounder, cod, and tuna. And so they're wondering for Alabama if there was a lot of damage to the estuary by Hurricane Ivan that might interrupt the harvest of these different seafood organisms.
Yes, that's true. And actually, marine resource personnel are actually assessing that damage right now. We are so excited that we have made it through this program. The weather here today is Hurricane Ivan again. Thank you so much. Peconics, it's your turn. Bye, everybody. We survived. Yay. See you later next year.